Hello and welcome aboard this podcast of RTÉ Radio 1's maritime programme Seascapes, which is presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. Hello and welcome aboard this week's edition of your maritime programme Seascapes. We'll be hearing shortly from documentary filmmaker Richie O'Donnell on his new project on our maritime resources in the Atlantic. Ronan Enright has all the details on the ISAF Women's Match Racing World Championships, which begin next week out of the Royal Cork Yacht Club off Camden Fort Mar in Crosshaven. First on Seascapes this week, to the Western Seaboard, and a photographer, a native Galwegian, who began taking photographs in the 60s as a teenager with his mother's Instamatic. He joined the Connacht Tribune in 1970 and later became staff photographer with the Sunday Tribune, also joining the Sunday Times. A beautifully produced book of his photographs of Ireland's Western Islands has just been published by the Collins Press, and we have copies in our Seascapes competition. The photographer is John Carlos, and he explained how he began taking photographs.
I suppose the genesis of it was in the middle 60s, when my mother used to bring myself and my two sisters to Inishmore for a few consecutive summers on a short holiday. And it was a place my Uncle Jerry used to go to as well. And he used to regale us with stories about the various photographers from different nationalities who used to frequent the island and photograph the traditional aspects and all that. And I suppose the bug bit earlier on when he told us about these stories. I remember one day asking if one of the English photographers if he could teach me how to take a photograph, and he showed me this field with a horse in it, and he talked about the subject matter and composition and all that. And I didn't understand a thing, needless to say. But my mother rode in and gave me a Kodak Instamatic camera that she used to use. And it was a great little point and shoot camera that had just come out in the mid 60s. This would have been 63 onwards. And that's really how I started, with a bit of trial and error, you know. Then later on, when I became a photographer, a trainee photographer in the local paper, the Connacht Tribune, I returned to Aran to start taking photographs there. I was always drawn to the islands. And at various stages, my own paper, the Connacht Tribune and the Irish Times used quite a bit of material for me. I also designed my own pages of pictures for the Connacht Tribune. And I used to get quite a good response to it, you know. So that's basically how it started, Marcus. One of the photographers, but this was later on, whom I discovered, was the great American master called Paul Strand. And one of my favourite authors, John Berger, had written an essay which I read first before I discovered Strand and his work. And Berger refers to Strand, you know, in a sense that he encourages a biographical moment to arise in all his portraits. I try to emulate that to a certain extent, as well as taking on my own style. As I say, a process of trial and error. I was a little bit aimless at times, but I just kept trying to broaden my vision and knuckling down to it by returning to the islands and taking pictures. You mentioned there about that picture of the Gaelgeoirí, one of them with a tennis racket in his hand, disembarking from one of the Corks. Well, that day was almost like a pet creative day for me, because myself and my sister and some friends went to Inishir. And in those days, the Ní Véine, which is controversial at the moment, used to service the three islands, and that particular day they went to Inishmore first and, you know, dropped supplies and hoisted on animals like horses, and they brought in cows and all that, and then went to the other islands, but they couldn't moor at the actual piers on the other islands until recent years. And in those days they used to leave off the supplies and swim the animals in by curragh, which were rowed in by the island men who serviced the islands from the mooring, from the Nivena that was moored out beyond, you know. Yeah, so those pictures are kind of historical now in a sense, Marcus, you know, and you wonder at times where the time is gone, you know.
Ireland's Western Islands feature striking imagery, and John Carless has documented several generations of islanders, like the images of Laura Hopkins in her grandparents and the centenarian Bridget Duran on the facing page within the book.
My idea there on that juxtaposition was not just about youth and age from the islands, but to emphasise how Laura's mother, Catherine Concannon, is from Inishturk. She now works in Westport, and that's what a lot of the women have to do from some of the islands. It's not like the old days where, say, for instance, they went to national school on the island and then progressed to secondary school on the so-called mainland and then returned to the island and married back into the island. Nowadays, it's different. It's their own prerogative and right to go to third level education. And they end up either going abroad or else settling on the mainland and getting married and living there, you know. Laura kind of epitomised for me that great confidence in children nowadays, and also just to portray the kind of depopulation also of some of the islands like Inishturk. I remember going there maybe 15 years ago with the journalist Susan McKay from the Sunday Tribune, and I remember taking a picture in the local school, the national school, and I think there were 13 children in the picture. And if you go in there now, there are only three, and two of them are from the same family and the other is a cousin of theirs. So you can see the changes only in that short time, Marcus, you know.
It's obviously a place that keeps drawing you back, John. How long did this book take, and was it a difficult task in terms of narrowing down the images you wanted to put within its pages?
It took, I suppose, all my working life so far, which is, we'll say, over 40 years. One of the images on the Aran Islands I took as a young fellow, and I decided to include it as it was kind of central to the story as well. That's a picture of a child called Trasa Hernan, who now runs the guest house where she grew up in. I just approached it in a kind of as spontaneously as I could. There was very little planning, except that at one stage I said I would like to do a book if ever I had enough work collected. And it's a little bit like life, that I embraced the mystery and just to see where the story would lead me. And eventually, you know, I found that my work was differing somewhat to my newspaper work. In my newspaper work, you act as a kind of a recorder of events, and the work, you know, is descriptive in nature. Whereas what I was trying to do in the book was to place the camera within the community, and so as I could act as a kind of protagonist or storyteller, which is very difficult. But the story only comes alive with the sequencing. It's all in the sequencing, and there's no correct way of achieving this, but neither is there a correct way of interpreting it. And I didn't want to impose my views as such on the viewer. I much preferred that it becomes a kind of a collaborative effort where the viewer and the photographer and the protagonists of the story, which effectively are the islanders, come together at this kind of rendezvous, as John Berger calls it. And the story then unfolds or comes alive as the viewer peruses through the pages, you know. Part of the imagery, for instance, there's one of Barbara Day, which people love, actually, and it's one I like myself. I had to redo that picture because the one I took before that didn't really pay her any justice, as it were. But she's wearing modern attire, like Levi's jeans with a Levi's buckle and kind of a modern type T-shirt with denim shirt or whatever. And my idea there was to show that, like, the kids on any of the islands are as modern looking and in their and also in their views as anyone you might get in Manhattan of a similar age, or people walking down the Champs-Élysées in Paris, you know. And it's something I battled with as I worked on the islands over the 40 years. And at the same time, you know, I was coming through my own journey, as it were, you know, of personal development, trying to broaden my scope and my vision. And I found it very difficult to coalesce that modernity with the traditional aspects of the island, which I loved, you know. The Light Special, I think, for quite a few reasons, Marcus, not least that, you know, the Western Seaboard in Ireland is pitted against the Atlantic elements. So you have great changes in a very short time in the light. That was one of my most difficult, because, you know, anyone can go out and take a snapshot, but trying to achieve, say, a certain light that I might like is very difficult. You have to really return many times to the islands. And I suppose I was in a privileged position because I grew up in Galway. And although when I started the project in a definitive way, that was in, say, 1992, when I had kind of just developed my ideas and stuff, it's still not far to come from Dublin, where I worked in the Sunday Tribune. And I spent all my holiday time and time off in Loo. And if I can interject there and give a special thanks to Vincent Brown, my editor, who always supported me in this and gave me the time to carry out the work. But yeah, that's about it, Marcus, you know. When you think about it, I think in the 1800s there were something like 3,000 or 3,500 people on our offshore islands. Now there are less than 3,000, as far as I know. And we really have to look after our islanders and our islands. And hopefully this book will in some way help that initiative, you know.
John Carlos. You can win a copy of Ireland's Western Islands by John, courtesy of the Collins Press. All you've got to do is answer this question. Where is John Carlos from? Just name the city. Answers on a postcard to Seascapes, RTE Radio 1, Father Matthew Street in Cork, or by email seascapes@rte.ie. A new festival named in honour of a Limerick man who famously completed a solo circumnavigation of the world will take place along the banks of the River Shannon in Limerick on Sunday next. Spectators will be gathered on either side of the river at Harvey's Quay and Clancy Strand. There'll be rowing and sailing regattas, a historic kayak tour of Limerick City, and a gandolo boat demonstration. The late Pat Lawless made international headlines in 1996 when the then 70-year-old sailed his 30-foot vessel, the Sea Dog, up the Shannon Estuary on the final leg of his 30,000-mile around-the-world voyage. Mr. Lawless was a member of Inishkaltra Sailing Club in Mount Shannon, and he passed away in 2010. At nearby Foyne's Yacht Club this coming weekend, the Munster Mermaids Championships will take place. On Saturday, two races will take place east of Foyne's Island in an Olympic triangular course, and on Sunday, one race is scheduled in Foyne's Harbour so that the public can view the spectacular sport. A total of 12 boats will be competing over the 2 days, with 7 coming from the East Coast and the remainder from Foyne's Yacht Club. Keep an eye out, by the way, for visiting tall ships in Dublin Bay this weekend. You can see more detail on our webpage or on sailtrainingireland.ie. Now on Seascapes to the ISAF Women's Match Racing World Championships. Earlier this week, Seascapes spoke with event chairman Ronan Enright.
ISAF is the International Sailing Federation. It's the world governing body for sailing. This event has been running since 1999. It started in Genoa in Italy in 1999. It's been running every year since. It's travelled all around the world. It's been to some very prestigious places around the world, such as Newport in Rhode Island, Bermuda, Auckland in New Zealand. So we're very lucky to have it here in Cork. We're very lucky to have it in Ireland. There was a bidding process for us to get it to Ireland, and it came down to a choice between ourselves and Long Beach, California. So when you say we want to get the weather, we very much would like to get some good weather for the event so that we can welcome the competitors. The host club is the Royal Cork Yacht Club, which is we're very lucky to have in Ireland. It's the oldest sailing club in the world. The course itself will be held just below Camden Fort Mar, which if your listeners haven't been to, they should consider taking a visit to. It's a fantastic old artillery naval fort. It's a labyrinth of tunnels under the hill. 65% of it is underground. And we came upon the idea in collaboration with the volunteers who run Fort Camden and with Cork County Council to use Camden Fort Mar as the main viewing platform for this event. So if anybody would like to go watch the racing happening, they could go down to Camden Fort Mar from 9:30 to 4:30 on either Wednesday the 4th, Thursday the 5th, Saturday the 7th, or Sunday the 8th of June. And they'll be able to go into the fort. They'll be able to see a little bit of what the fort is about. It'll draw attention to the wonderful tourist facilities we have in Cork Harbour. And they'll be able to watch the racing just down below them. There's a magnificent viewing platform there, and they'll be have a bird's eye view down on the race course.
Now, tell us about some of the competitors, because obviously they're drawn from quite a number of countries. And of course, we're represented by some of our finest women sailors here.
Yes, it really is. It attracts top level female sailors from around the world. We're very lucky in that we have 5 of the world's current top 10 coming to the event, which is a good representation for people coming to Ireland. We have 2 Irish teams, as you mentioned. There were trials to pick the Irish teams. They were nominated by the Irish Sailing Association, which is the national governing body. And we have Mary O'Loughlin, who will be skippering one team, and Laura Dillon, who will be skippering another team for Ireland. We have the world number one, Camilla Uckelholm, who's a Danish lady, and she'll be coming with her team, with high hopes of doing very well in the event. We've had fantastic support from Cork County Council and from Port of Cork and from Cork City Council. And as part of that, what we decided to do was on Friday the 6th of June, in the afternoon from 2 to 6 p.m., we're going to bring the boats up into the city centre. And they'll be racing just off Albert Quay, just in front of Port of Cork itself. There's going to be a small festival on the City Quays on Albert Quay. There'll be music from 2 to 6. We've a great lineup of musicians playing for the day. There'll be some food stalls. There'll be beverages available, etc. Something that should be a great draw, hopefully, for people is the Naval Services new ship, the Samuel Beckett, will be docked on the City Quays as part of the event. That'll be open for public tours. It'll be the first time that she's come to Cork for public tours, and we hope that people will come down. They'll enjoy some food, a drink or a soft drink. They'll listen to some music. Mehl Mara will be carrying out some rowing races on the river that day. So we hope there's a general buzz of maritime activity for people to see on a Friday afternoon.
So Ronan, if people want to find out more about the racing, more about the sailors and more about the overall event, is there a website they can visit?
Yeah, we've set up a dedicated website, Marcus. It's www.matchracing.ie, and there's profiles of the sailors there, and there's also a programme of all the events. And as I said, if anybody would like to come down, Camden Fort Mar will be the viewing platform most days other than Friday afternoon, where you'll be able to see it from Albert Quay.
You can see and read more about the event on the Seascapes webpage, www.rte.ie/radio1/seascapes. Next on Seascapes to documentary filmmaker Richie O'Donnell and his follow-up to the remarkable The Pipe, This project, Richie explained to Seascapes from our Galway studios, concerns our exploration of our maritime resources in the Atlantic.
I did a documentary 3 years ago, which was about the community at the centre of the Corrib gas controversy. And a lot of the story was based at sea with a crab fisherman called Pat O'Donnell. And while filming the pipe, even though it was a very local, kind of an intimate story, kind of a portrait of a community in turmoil, it raised a lot of questions about our offshore resources, about what decisions had been made at a much higher level that plunged this community into such chaos. And while trying to find out about what oil and gas resources potentially we have, what are the politics behind it, what is the history behind it, I also became very aware of another resource story which I wasn't very much aware of before, which is the fishing and the history of our fishing resource, and I suppose the poor management of our fishing resource in the past. And that led on then to me trying to make a documentary not just about the oil and gas resources in the country, but about all our offshore resources, including the fishing and even including things like seaweed, energy, and the mismanagement of some of these resources, and why as Irish people, both our people and our politicians, our civil servants, have very little regard to our offshore. Because, I mean, our offshore, something that surprised me, 90% of our territory is sea, it's offshore. Yet we have very, very poor regard for it. And that's what was really the starting point for me trying to make this documentary. In broad strokes, the thing that struck me going back over the history of the dealing of all our resources was the attitude which we take to our resources. It's a vast, vast area, our offshore. People in Ireland find it very hard to get a picture, really, of the value of our resource and the scale of it. People in Ireland, I think, culturally, we understand land. We understand property. We understand what a field of grass is or a piece of bog. If that in any way is threatened, you know, people will take to the street. We saw it in the case of Corrib. It was over the land issue which really became a motive for Irish people. But yet, if, let's say, our offshore is being handed away, or huge control of it is being handed away, we really miss it, you know? We really don't get it. And it was interesting because I've gone to Norway, and people in Norway, they've, and in Newfoundland, they've really managed their resources very well. Not only their oil and gas resources, our potential resources, but also their fishing resources, their other energy resources. They really value it. And it may be a cultural thing. It may be that the Norwegians in the past, they looked to the sea as they put much more value on their fishing. It was a trade route. The land was very poor, so the sea was much richer for them in terms of their eyes. Whereas in Ireland, it was the opposite. We see the sea as a stepping stone, really, to other lands and a better life. Whereas, and in the past, I mean, fishermen were often looked down as a class below the farmers, as poor people. So it probably is a cultural thing. And I think we really have to become aware of the sheer value of our offshore resources. I was down in Castletown Bay last Friday on the pier last Friday morning. 12 French and Spanish boats unloaded onto fishing lorries, filled them up, and they went off to the continent. The Spanish and French boats went back out to sea. In that time when I was there, no Irish boats landed in Castletown Bear. Most of them were tied up. Even them lorries coming into Castletown Bear, they'll bring their own supplies. I mean, they don't shop in the supermarket in Castletown Bear. They'll bring their toilet roll, their food, their whatever else they need. They'll bring that from Spain. They'll bulk buy it. So the return to Castletown Bear is very low, maybe a few harbour fees or a fill of diesel. This documentary is a co-production between Norway, Newfoundland and Ireland. In Ireland, we're going the crowdfunding route, which means that we're appealing to different people, businesses, anybody who has an interest in our offshore, or even just normal people who feel this is a story that should get made. Because as I said before, we as Irish people have very little value on our offshore and we don't realise when other countries or other companies see way more value in it than us. And before we know it, the resource is gone outside of our control and it's too late. Like what happened with the fishing, like what's possibly happening with the oil and gas, and even what's happening with our seaweed rights at the moment, which is another story. We have a crowdfunding website we're on. It's called fundit.ie. And on that, people can log in and they can pledge some money. So if they give, say, 10 euros, they get a digital download of the film when it's done. If they pledge 25 euros, they get a hard copy of the DVD. And on upwards, we have different rewards like tickets to the premiere, like field trips, your name in the credits, things like that. So the response has been fantastic. We've raised about 11,000 so far. We're halfway through filming. So we need to reach a target of 25,000 in the next 2 weeks in order to complete the filming. We're just going out to the people, getting out on the street, going on social media. We're hosting debates, concerts, any way to try and bring people in, try and get awareness of this documentary, of the issues, and hopefully they'll invest in the story with us and become part owners of this story and help us bring this story to a much, much wider audience and really allow people, Irish people, to see how our resources have been managed in the past, the huge value of our resources and the potential of our resources. Because, I mean, the fishing villages around the country are dying of debt, and fishing could be on a par with agriculture in terms of exports and in terms of the financial value of it. What filming in Newfoundland and Norway does is it informs us about, in our story, about how others have managed. And even in the case of Newfoundland's fishing, how maybe they've mismanaged their resource to the detriment. So to bring that all together in one story, three separate stories from Norway, Newfoundland and Ireland, through the perspective of fishing communities, to tell the story of the natural resources of the North Atlantic. And as I say, we're fundraising through fundit.ie, and any contribution, small or big, is a huge boost for us to tell the story, because this is a story which really has to be told before it's too late.
Richie O'Donnell, documentary filmmaker, and you can see more details on our webpage. This weekend, there are maritime-related festivals right around our coastline. As always, if you're going on or near the water, do think about safety and wear a life jacket. You can always get more information on the Irish Water Safety website, which is www.iws.ie. Next week here on Seascapes, we preview the Fastnet Maritime Festival. Tom Hurley is in Killaloe on the trail of the Lady Lansdowne, the world's oldest surviving iron paddle steamship. We've a report on the Ocean to City Maritime Festival and on Ross Moore with Niamh Riley. Results of our Seascapes competition for those copies of John Carliffe's Ireland's Western Islands. And a report from the ISAF Women's Match Racing World Championships. All that and much more here on your maritime programme. Until next Friday night, tight lines and fair sailing.